It's 6 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Steve Norman reporting. Millions of people in the U.S. state of Florida dealing with heavy rains, high winds from Hurricane Irma as it makes its way up the west coast of the state. Such a major hurricane has not hit the region in more than 100 years. President Trump declared Florida a major disaster area, and the state's governor, Rick Scott, spoke about the situation.
I know a lot of people are praying for us around the world. I know a lot of people want to help us. I tell them we need more volunteers. We have over 400 shelters open now, but we'll need volunteers after the fact to distribute food and water and clean up debris.
Among the many shelters across Florida are those operated by the American Red Cross. Their spokesperson, Nigel Hollerby, is in Orlando, Florida.
This is a massive operation. We have thousands of volunteers that are deployed, and we are still even monitoring this storm as it goes north of us here. So in Orlando, we know that this is not the end of where the storm will cause some damage or to create a problem for folks.
Before reaching Florida, Irma left at least 25 dead across the Caribbean and virtually flattened some islands, including Barbuda, where residents have been told they have to leave the island, more than likely permanently. The U.S. has deployed the Navy, the Marines, the Air Force to help recovery efforts there, as well as taking care of the people on the Dutch Caribbean island of St. Martin, which also suffered severe damage along with the U.S. territories, Puerto Rico, and the U.S. Virgin Islands. Reuters reporting now that Al-Shabaab militants captured the Somali border town of Balad-Howell near Kenya after it detonated a suicide car bomb, then stormed a military base early today. The group says 24 Somali soldiers were killed, but there was no independent confirmation. This is VOA News. UN Security Council set to vote today on a weakened U.S. draft resolution to impose new sanctions on North Korea over its latest nuclear test. The resolution was changed in a bid to appease North Korea's ally China and Russia, which might not vote for the version, any version, they say, of implementing more sanctions. The draft seen by Reuters no longer proposes blacklisting North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. The initial draft proposed he be subjected to a travel ban and an asset freeze along with four other North Korean officials. The final text only lists one of those officials. North Korea said today the U.S. would have a price to pay if more sanctions were imposed on it. An offer of a month-long ceasefire by the Muslim militants in western Myanmar has apparently been rejected as a number of displaced Rohingya refugees seeking safe haven in neighboring Bangladesh has swelled to nearly 300,000. The Arkan Rohingya Salvation Army, or ARSA, declared a unilateral truce so aid could reach the refugees. Carnegie Endowment Southeast Asia analyst Vikram Nehru is not surprised the government would refuse to deal with a group they called terrorists.
The recent information is that the ARSA forces are being led by jihadis with links to Saudi Arabia and Pakistan and has given some credence to the argument that the Myanmar armed forces have been making that these are terrorists.
ARSA is blamed for sparking an army crackdown after its fighters launched coordinated attacks on security forces last month. Pope Francis ended his trip to Colombia by appealing to the people to unite to end more than a half century of armed conflict. Speaking at a mass in Cartagena, he said if Colombia wants a stable and lasting peace, it must untie the knots of violence and unravel the complex threads of disagreement. He also expressed what he called his closeness to each one of the sons and daughters of Venezuela. Colombia's neighbor has long been embroiled in years of economic and political crisis. The death toll from the massive earthquake that rocked southern Mexico has now risen to at least 90, with most of the fatalities in Oaxaca State. The powerful 8.2 magnitude quake struck off Mexico's far southern Pacific coast just before midnight on Thursday. And Rafael Nadal has earned his third U.S. Open tennis championship and his 16th Grand Slam title of his career with a win over Kevin Anderson of South Africa.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa, and welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, and today is Monday, September the 11th, and here are some of the stories we're covering for you. The World Health Organization says that more than 500 people have died so far in a cholera epidemic that is sweeping the Democratic Republic of the Congo. And in West Africa, human rights groups say that military operations by armed forces in Mali and Burkina Faso, operations to counter the growing presence of Islamist armed groups in central Mali, have resulted in serious human rights violations.
We documented nearly every detainee as suffering some sort of abuse at the end of last year, as the presence of armed groups in central Mali increased, and then as the army operations increased in those areas, we really have started to see a backsliding on what had been some improvement in their behavior.
Corinne Dufka is the Human Rights Watch Sahel Director. And in Gambia, a commission of inquiry is underway to probe the financial dealings of the former president Yahya Jammeh. And Liberians are gearing up for polls in less than a month from now.
The underlying message I think we're hearing from the Liberians, citizens, voters, is cynicism, skepticism, because they feel that they've heard it all before. Politicians have come, legislative candidates, senatorial candidates, presidential, representative candidates have come, made promises, and they've been let down.
Alexander Cummings of the Alternative National Congress Party. He is running in a crowded field of over 20 candidates vying to replace Africa's first female president, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. We will bring you an interview he had with VOA's James Batty, who is covering the campaigns in Liberia's capital, Monrovia. And festivities in Kampala to mark the opening of the third edition of the East African Community Arts and Culture Festival. And we'll take you to the streets of Kampala, where they had festivities to mark the opening of the third edition of the East African Community Arts and Culture Festival. Those stories, plus an Africa Sports Roundup, are coming up right here on Daybreak Africa. The World Health Organization says that more than 500 people have died so far in a cholera epidemic that is sweeping the Democratic Republic of Congo. Outbreaks of the waterborne disease occur regularly in Congo, mainly due to poor sanitation and the lack of access to clean drinking water. But this year's epidemic, which has already hit at least 10 urban areas, including the capital Kinshasa, is particularly worrying, as it comes about 1.4 million people have been displaced by violence in the central Kasai region. The WHO say that at least 528 people had died and the epidemic had spread to 20 of Congo's 26 provinces. So far, health officials have recorded more than 24,000 suspected cases of the disease across the vast nation this year. This is an average of more than 1,500 new cases per week since the end of July. The WHO sent a team of experts, including epidemiologists and public health specialists, to Congo this month in an effort to contain the spread of cholera. According to a new report released by Human Rights Watch, Mali and Burkina Faso military operations to counter the growing presence of Islamist armed groups in central Mali have resulted in serious human rights violations. The report says that since late 2016, Malian forces have committed extrajudicial killings, enforced disappearances, torture, and arbitrary arrests against men accused of supporting Islamist armed groups. Human Rights Watch Sahel Director Corinne Dufka talks to Ricky Shryok about how these abuses actually serve as recruitment tools for Islamists.
The armed Islamist groups use these abuses as a recruitment tool. This has been the case since at least 2015, since the growth of armed Islamist groups has rapidly increased in those areas. And the types of abuses we documented are extremely serious. The army had really improved their behavior from 2013 and 2014, where We documented nearly every detainee as suffering some sort of abuse. But at the end of last year, as the presence of armed groups in Central Mali increased, and then as the army operations increased in those areas, we really had started to see a backsliding on what had been some improvement in their behavior.
Have the abuses increased sympathy toward the jihadist groups?
Yes, I've spoken with a good number of people who have attended meetings organized by the jihadists in central Mali, in which they bring up a number of grievances against the state, including abuses meted out by the armed forces. They note particularly that young men have been tortured and that they have detained and beaten elder residents as well. Now, we don't necessarily say that all of those who are being detained are being arbitrarily detained.
In your research, you cite an older man from Mondoro administrative area. Could you talk about what he said he saw? Because he seemed to cite violence from both sides. And
many of the abuses that are documented in this report occurred in the areas near Mali's border with Burkina Faso. And the abuses we documented involved both the Malian army as well as the Burkina Faso army. And civilians in that area feel trapped between two sides. They suffer abuses by the armed Islamists, including the killing of local government officials and even the beheading of one young man who was accused of providing information to the army. And on the other hand, they have endured detentions, sometimes nearly all the male population from a hamlet have been detained by the armies.
Is the Malian government not holding these soldiers accountable because they lack the resources or because they lack the will to do so?
Since 2013, I have consistently met with the Malian government, including members of the judiciary, as well as members of the armed forces, to share with them my research and urge them to take these abuses seriously. And they have consistently failed to do so. Even during my last mission in July, I met with a member of the armed forces to share some of this information. So this suggests that the Malian army, or this suggests that the Malian government lacks the political will to hold accountable soldiers involved in these abuses.
That was Corinne Dufka, Human Rights Watch Sahel director. She was speaking to Ricky Shryok from Washington. And today marks 29 more days before Liberians cast their ballots on October 10th for the next president to succeed Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. One of the 20 presidential candidates is former Coca-Cola executive Alexander Cummings of the Alternative National Congress Party. A few months ago, Mr. Cummings was considered an outsider and little unknown by Liberian voters. Now, he tells VOA's James Batty, who is on assignment in Liberia, that if he is elected, part of his focus will be on primary health care because it impacts the majority of Liberians.
The underlying message I think we're hearing from Liberians, citizens, voters, is cynicism, skepticism, because they feel that they've heard it all before. Politicians have come, legislative candidates, senatorial candidates, presidential, vice presidential candidates have come, made promises, and they've been like that. And that cynicism pervades the electorate in Liberia. And what we're saying to them is, look, the best way to predict future behavior and future performance is past behavior, past performance. So if you look at my history of performance, of delivery, of behavior, it should give you some confidence that I'll do what I'll say. And in fact, Liberians have now coined me a talk and do, or clean hands, something I embrace. And this is what our people would get if they give me the opportunity to serve them as president. And so that message is resonating. The other thing that's resonating with our people is the fact that I say to them, we must believe in ourselves. We must believe in Liberia, and we must believe we deserve a better Liberia.
I had a chance to visit the red light market area, and because I feel that would be the kind of microcosm if I want to gauge what's happening here before I begin to talk to you and any other presidential candidate. And I sat down with a couple of market people there who were selling, trying to make ends meet. The women there were very passionate about their own concerns, particularly they would like to see a market, a building where they can call their own, because they complain about police people coming and driving them out every day. They want money to be able to pay their children's tuition and the roads. If they vote for Alexander Cummings, how would you take care of their needs?
We will. We want to implement policies that will impact the majority of Liberian people. So, talk about the fact that they need money and they need credit to run their businesses. We will make sure in the first 100 days, James will identify waste and savings in government, and we'll redeploy that to provide credit to Liberian businesses. Actually to all businesses, but focus on Liberian businesses, including Liberian market women. That's one of the major impediments to growing the businesses is the lack of money, the lack of credit. So we'll focus on that. We'll focus on the roads. We believe we should privatize infrastructure, meaning looking at public-private partnerships, bring investors in to invest in our roads, electricity, water, and internet and cellular connectivity. So we will very aggressively, on an accelerated basis, look at how we can bring investors to invest in that so we can meet the needs those people discuss. We're going to focus on primary health care. Why is that important? Most Liberians are impacted every day by things like malaria, typhoid, diarrhea, our mothers, sisters, wives having children. And so we want to focus on primary health care because it impacts most Liberians.
In the last debate, one of your competitors, Senator Weah, wasn't there. And I read in the papers you had a comment about, I think you call, you say he's a copycat. Also, the vice president recently, during that debate, mentioned something about, I think he compared himself to a race car. You had something to also say about that. Now, is there, would you like, do you think it's incumbent upon every candidate to face the people and during the debate to show up in the debate?
I think so. You know, again, I'm trying to focus my campaign, my candidacy on the issues and not to personalize it. But since you asked the question, it's a fair question, I'm obliged to answer. And I would say you cannot want to lead a people, a country, without being prepared to face questions from those people or their proxies. The fourth estate, the press, is the proxy for our people. And all candidates, including Senator Weah, again, no disrespect to Senator Weah, but he should have been at that debate to face the questions of our people. I think Liberian people were disappointed. I certainly was disappointed that he wasn't there to answer those questions, because we should be prepared as candidates to answer any or all questions the Liberian people have of us if we truly want to lead and serve them. So I also said, because when you read the CDC's policy statement and documents, it is a copycat of ours. But you know, they say the best way to compliment somebody is, the best form of flattery is when you're copied.
So you think so, the CDC is copying you?
I believe so. If you can just read the policy documents.
Liberian presidential candidate Alexander Cummings of the Alternative National Congress Party. He was speaking to VOA's James Batty, who is in Liberia. In Gambia, as the Commissioner of Inquiry probing the financial dealings of the former President Yahya Jammeh intensifies, there are more revelations as to how millions of dollars were withdrawn from the central bank and some commercial banks. People from all walks of life have been reacting to news, as we hear this in the report by Sene Marena in Bonjour.
The commission is looking at how the state monies were used by the former president. Many witnesses have testified and they have given revelations how millions of dollars and in Dalasi were withdrawn by the former president. We are here at Westfield, the busy Kairava Avenue, talking to people from all walk of life about the ongoing commission of inquiry.
And those testify that are involved and the signatory to those accounts, they know the procedures and they know that it is not right to sign such a document, but they do so. best reason known to them. Actually, I think that those people should be prosecuted.
We have all witnessed that the previous government have been squandering money and nobody knows exactly the source of that money is coming from. I think the establishment of this commission is a very good initiative so that Gambians can know actually how their monies have been spent.
But I think it's also good that they pay attention to the current system that is happening. That you don't wait until it's passed. You pay attention to the current thing so that people will be aware of what is happening than just focusing on just the past.
Basically, I think it's a good thing because I don't think any government can move forward if we don't know what has been happening in the past.
Mr. Karamo Jaura, a senior official from Central Bank of the Gambia, revealed that the former dictator used his power and influence to withdraw millions of dollars from 22 different bank accounts he operated.
The next was 21st August 2014, $500,000. The equivalent is $21,375,000. This one, the request was signed by A.M. Sala.
Tony Gattas, a business partner of the former exiled Gambian president Yahya Jammeh, has come under heavy scrutiny by the Commission of Inquiry as the financial inquest continues. And here, the Guaranty Trust Bank MD, Mr. Bolaji, explained how monies were also withdrawn by agents of the former president.
I know there was a commission that was set up in terms of tax recovery, and these accounts were opened. This account was opened, and it was in the public domain that people can pay in tax recovered into that account.
The question now is, will the country recover the millions of dollars and dollars misused by the ex-president and his close associates? I am Seni M.K. Marena.
Thank you, Seni. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. And the third edition of the East African Community Arts and Culture Festival kicked off yesterday in Kampala. The festival is expected to attract more than 60,000 people. Moses Havyarimana is in Uganda's capital, Kampala. He has this story.
It all started with a street carnival in the heart of Kampala, where main roads were blocked as six East African member states of Burundi, Rwanda, South Sudan, Kenya, Tanzania, and Uganda showcased their culture and traditional dances, marking the third time the festival is organized. Ruth Anyeko is a Ugandan citizen.
It's really exciting. I've never seen a Burundi dance like how those people dance and the energy that those people put in when dancing. It's really exciting. It's nice to watch. Like, it's nice to watch traditional dances. At least today I've known something. I've learned something from them. Because I've watched the culture, I've seen and I've asked questions this one, that way. The royal dance, I've watched it and I guess I'll not get to know more.
JAMAFEST, a Swahili acronym from Jumuiya Afrika Mashariki ni Utamaduni Festival, meaning the East African Culture Festival, is aimed at promoting regional social cultural integration through arts and culture by providing a regional platform to showcase culture as the prime driver for the East African community integration. This song was specifically produced for this third edition of the festival, which takes place in every 2 years. Nicole Irakoze is a youth and was the choir leader. She says that the platform gave her an opportunity to showcase her talent.
I'm doing music. I love it. And I do classic and contemporary. I'm like a honor, like to be part on the choir.
In the East African community, more than 60% of the population are youth. Poverty and rising unemployment is among the challenges youth living in the East African face. At Kololo, in Uganda's capital Kampala, during the official opening, Uganda's Prime Minister Ruhakana Rugunda said that the regional culture festival is the engine of unity and creation of employment, especially for the youth.
There is nothing as powerful as using arts and our talents to tell the East African story. JAMAFEST informs us that we are a people with a common destiny and common aspirations. Historically, all Africans were united by culture. there was free movement of people and sharing of resources.
The East African Art and Culture Festival is expected to run for 7 days, as artists and traders from 6 East African countries are expected to showcase their talents and their traditions. Thousands of East Africans are expected to attend the one-week festival as a result of implementation of the Common Market Protocol that liberalized the free movement of people within the East African region. Moses Habyarimana, VOA Africa, Kampala.
Thank you, Moses. It's time for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here's Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria, with this morning's roundup of Africa Sports. Good morning, Samson.
A good Monday morning to you, Jackson. We begin with the 2017 West African Football Union Cup of Nations, popularly known as the WAFU Cup, which began on Saturday. Host Ghana and Senegal have booked their places at the next stage of the tournament after hard-fought wins on the opening day of the sub-regional tournament in Cape Coast, Ghana. Ghana left it late to beat Gambia 1-0 in the tournament opener before Senegal edged Liberia 5-4 in penalties to book their places at the group stage. Maxwell Konadu is the Black Stars Team B coach.
I also have to congratulate my boys. You know, playing in front of your home fans, and if the goals are not coming, you know, the fans were yelling for goals and it wasn't coming, but the boys kept their composure and made sure that everything was handled very, very well.
Staying with the WAFU Cup, Niger recorded a stunning victory over pre-tournament favorites Burkina Faso to book their place in the group stage in the ongoing WAFU Cup of Nations. Guinea also reached the next stage of the competition. They are the fourth team to qualify after Ghana, Senegal and Niger. Later today, it will be Mali versus Mauritania and Nigeria will face Sierra Leone. And now to Kenya, where a delegation of CAF officials led by Second Deputy President Constant Omar will be in Kenya from today to continue their appraisal of Kenya's ability to host the African Nations Championship CHAN awarded to the country in 2015. The second deputy president of CAF, accompanied by 6 other CAF officials, will be determining Kenya's readiness to host a tournament that features national team players who ply their trade in their local leagues. Speculations have been rife that the country might not be ready to host the 16-team tournament. We stay with football, and South African Football Association, SAFA, will later today convene an emergency meeting to discuss FIFA's decision to order a replay between Bafana Bafana and Senegal. Late on Saturday, SAFA's president, Danny Jordan, had indicated that SAFA intends to appeal the decision of FIFA. And now to auto sports, and Tunisia's women volleyball team won the first qualifying round for the 2017 Women's African Nations Championship after defeating Algeria 3-1 in the game played on Saturday in Bajaia. From volleyball to tennis, where first-time Grand Slam finalist and the first South African to reach the U.S. Open final in the Open era since 1968, Kevin Anderson of South Africa lost the U.S. Open final to Rafael Nadal 6-3, 6-3, 6-4 on Sunday.
It's been, definitely a summer. I can take a lot of positives from, getting into the finals of my first Grand Slam. It's really been a lot of emotions I've had to deal with throughout the week. Today was obviously a tough match for me. I was up against a pretty good opponent who knows how to play.
And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, Jackson, in Washington.
And thank you, Samson. And that's it for this Monday, September the 11th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm Jackson Mvunganyi in Washington, wishing you all a very good day, Africa.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, fresh off a three-nation Africa visit to the Democratic Republic of Congo, Zambia, and Tanzania, Shaka Sali talks about the fascinating people he met and the challenges he encountered, reporting on democracy in Africa. On the Road with Shaka, on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.